How you doing?
Is that going to be the only pun of the evening, or you got
no? you should know me better than that by now.
We haven't been as punny lately. I mean, I guess particularly on the internet, but
well, sometimes I'm tired. So sue me.
I understand. I understand that.
Have you ever felt tired, Dan?
Have I ever felt tired? Let me check real quick.
Have you ever thought about starting a podcast by saying you're tired? Just consider doing it once in a while.
I usually start by saying, how's it going? And then I say, I'm tired. But, you know. We don't have to read the same script every time.
No. This is a completely different and unique adaptation of our normal script.
Yeah.
But we're only going to do half an episode this time.
Right. I'm just going to say, yeah, I'm tired, but then I'm not going to explain why.
No. But there will be a lot of very beautiful visuals, which you get with these podcasts, listeners.
Yeah.
You just don't realize it. Just make sure you go into the settings and turn on beautiful visuals, and you'll get that.
Well, the key to getting the beautiful visuals is to record your podcast in QuickTime, and then to print that to DAT tape, and then scan that back in and save it as a QuickTime.
Yeah, that's how you get that timeless quality to it.
You get the cold crispness of the digital file, and you also get the warmth of the analog.
Mm-hmm.
Best of both worlds, I think, is what they say.
Yeah, that's that Star Trek episode I like. So,
Star Trek mm-hmm. to the best of both worlds.
Yeah, well, there's a very famous cliffhanger end of season 3 where Patrick Stewart as Jean-Luc Picard is abducted by the Borg, which is the cyborg race.
I know what the Borg is. You don't have to tell me.
Yeah, so he gets assimilated, and so he becomes the bad guy at the very end of that episode, and there was a big cliffhanger. And then the next season, they start it with the resolution to that cliffhanger, and how they get Picard back from the Borg. And that was the best of both worlds, part one and part two.
How'd they get him back?
Well, they had a convoluted plan where they split the ship in half then sent a shuttle in with the distraction, and then beamed in and grabbed Picard, and then beamed out, and then beamed out again of the shuttle because the shuttle got exploded. But they did that thing where you get the dramatic moment of, oh no, did they make it? And it's like be a short TV season if they didn't. But they got him back, and then they put him in a little like booth where he just stood there, and then had a bunch of threats and stuff until they managed to figure out how to deactivate some stuff, and then they put all the Borg to sleep, because that was the only thing that they could access in the Borg command network, and they hacked Picard's Borginess in order to get the Borg to go to sleep, and then there was some sort of failsafe that was triggered by that, going, oh no, they shouldn't all be asleep right now, and it blew up the Borg cube. So
say Borg a couple more times.
Borg. But the important part of that is Patrick Stewart, who was in Dune as Gurney Halleck in the 1984 adaptation by David Lynch, which you've seen 1.5 times now. And
yeah.
Yeah, and that pivots us over to the 2021 adaptation of Dune.
You know, I think, you know, I'm not going to go back and listen to those episodes in the same way that I'm not going to go back and watch the original Dune movie again. But I feel like if I were to have listened to those episodes again recently, I probably would have heard myself struggling to comprehend the plot of Dune and wondering if it's, you know, am I just stupid? Do I not get it? Is this poorly told? Is the plot actually convoluted, or is it just, you know, the issues with translating this large novel into it being a book? Like, am I missing something here? And after seeing Dune 2021, I can officially say, I think, now that I have 2 points on this graph, that it's not so much David Lynch's fault that the first movie is incoherent. It's that the story of Dune is kind of incoherent when you turn it into a movie.
Yeah. I will sort of vaguely agree with you here. I'm not as negative on either the 1984 film or this film. But
you don't have a strong feeling one way or the other?
Saving
that to the end.
They are
final judgments.
Yes, final judgments. That's what we're famous for. But they're different in their approach to adapting the source material. And they make different decisions about how to do that. And like you said, when you were rambling for a second, the big issue is that the original text is dense and not dense in like a lot of stuff happens with dialogue kind of a way, but in like a, I'm going to describe what the Orange Catholic Bible is and the various religions that have sort of synthetically been formed over the thousands and thousands of years. And oh, by the way, there was a robot uprising, which is Robert uprising. That's why we don't have Roberts anymore. They just have Jessica's and Paul's.
The Emperor has outlawed Roberts.
Yeah. But the all that stuff is in there and it's really dense. Like, oh, the Mentats are the way they are because they drink Sapho juice, which like dyes the lips of their and is one of the narcotics that they use in order to be able to do these mental calculations.
With the eyebrows, with the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, whether or not you feel like that is important to understanding Dune, I guess is sort of a personal thing because it's such a dense novel that if you were to like ask people to like pick out stuff to adapt from it, they might pick out different things in order to bring forwards. And I think that's kind of what we have here. I would say that they're not dramatically different in these two film adaptations are not dramatically different in what they choose to select of these portions. Because keep in mind, we also have a different problem where in 1984, it was expected that you would adapt the entire work. And Denis Villeneuve went to Legendary and said, I want to do this, but I only want to do this half of it because it's too long and too dense and too complicated in order to do the whole story. And while I agree with that decision, there are some downsides to making that decision. And so we can kind of only compare the adaptation of what Lynch did versus what Denny did to a point, because Denny still has to do part two in order to really figure out what the differences are. But obviously the end of the David Lynch Dune movie is probably the weakest portion of that film because it's very rushed to try to put all that stuff in there. You know, like, hey, there's a holy war that's happening and all of a sudden, you know, people have blue eyes that didn't have them at the beginning of the story. So it can become complicated for reasons when you're trying to rush that all together. And I think that Denny's going to have a different, he's not going to have the same problem because he's going to have probably two hours and 30 and something change is probably what he's going to be given to work with for adapting the second half of the book. And from what I remember slash have been told, we're a little further than halfway through with the ending that they went with in this part one. So it's mostly half, but it's like half and a little bit. It is just a different set of problems. I will say one of the things that I kind of expected from Denny in his adaptation is that he would have this expansive, immersive, atmospheric quality to the worlds that he was building visually, as opposed to a density to characters explaining things, which is what you got more of in the Lynch version, what obviously you have tons of in the book. So you have a lot of visual lushness in terms of detail of in the frame. Like you're given a lot here visually. And I don't feel like that was necessarily something that I ever doubted he'd be able to do.
No.
But what I did doubt was like whether or not he was going to be able to manage to do what needed to be done in terms of adapting the characters to make you care about them and adapt the very convoluted mechanics of the political machinations that are going on here. And I don't feel like he did either as effectively.
Yeah.
And there's also the added wrinkle of this being 2021 and we as an audience expect and are used to different things in our films, as opposed to when you would adapt something in 1984 or when you're reading a book in 1965. So there are some other oddities in here, like how many times have you seen a story about you know, the chosen one kid who grows up to be the guy. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. it happens.
I wonder if anyone in the story is going to doubt whether or not he's actually the chosen one.
Yeah.
Let alone himself.
I'll really throw a curveball in the whole plan. But yeah. It's one of those things where you have you're also given a different set of challenges because of just the time that has elapsed. And can Denny deal with those story things? And I feel like that's where he came up short, as opposed to the visual stuff, which I largely don't have a complaint with. There are some, you know, decisions that you can like say, hey, I don't really like the way that thing looked, or I don't like that one thing or whatever. But I feel like that is, in the grand scheme of things, not that significant as opposed to compared to the rest of what's going on visually, filling the frame all the time.
Yeah. If you saw Blade Runner 2049 and specifically Jared Leto's whatever house weirdness and stuff, and you just imagine in your mind that a studio backed the money train up to that same guy and said, have at it, you're going to get some really kind of crazy, epic looking imagery. And that's what you get in this movie. But one thing that I almost wonder if it hampered my viewing of this movie was having seen the first one. And for the first half of the 2021 movie, I was kind of doing a little mental back and forth going like, oh, here's that scene that's just like that other one in the first one. There's only two movies, right? There's more.
Well, I mean, okay. We'll just
call it Lynch's movie then.
Yeah, just say Lynch's movie. Because there's Lynch's movie, and then there's a TV cut that the producers and studio made of it. That's generally referred to as the Alan Smithy version because Lynch wanted his name taken off of it since he had no authority over the cut. And that one, I think a lot of people have seen on TV at some point, and that's the one with the weird narrator explaining things with matte paintings.
The lady with the stars and stuff.
No, she's not in that one. She's in the Lynch one. But there is, they replace her with some guy explaining stuff while there's matte paintings. And then there is the 2001 or 2002, the Dune miniseries that was for the Sci-Fi Channel, which was successful in terms of it being a Sci-Fi Channel original miniseries, but like, even liking stuff about Dune as much as I do, I would not put you through watching the miniseries. It makes a lot of questionable decisions. Although, arguably, it has more time and space to process character things. It looks like they spent $20 on it. So it's, you know, a different, very different situation.
Yeah. Look, you talk about spending time on certain things, and I think something we're already circling around but we should get to here specifically is when you're talking about making choices about what from the book to keep and to focus on to turn the source text into a motion picture, presumably the conversation is about what pieces in the book reinforce the themes and motivations of a given character and sort of move the plot along in a nice linear fashion. But one of the more complicated questions for me to answer about this movie is, what is it actually about? Like, what is this story about? Is it about Paul? In which case, do we really need so much of this other stuff? Is it about just like, it's just a story about Arrakis and what's going on there, and there just happens to be told through the lens of Paul? Like, there are so many different storylines and threads, and obviously that's because of the density of the source text and all of the fun stuff that they felt like putting in there for the world building, that it's difficult to watch this whole movie and to maintain in your mind the thread of, what am I supposed to be focused on, who am I supposed to be caring about, like, What does who want, and what do I feel about them and where they are in their journey to achieve those sorts of things?
Yeah. And like you said, this is also complicated by the fact that if you'd seen a previous adaptation of the work, or if you had read the original novel at some point, you know, not everybody remembers every moment of it, but I'm sure that if you would come across it at some point in your life, you would have some familiarity going into it. And when things start unfolding on screen, you'd kind of expect certain stuff to happen, or a character says a certain thing or something.
Yeah, there was a lot of just like, oh, this is that scene again, you know. Yeah. Okay, the one dude's flying. He's got a long dressy shirt on in this one. Mm-hmm. All right, here's the scene where the mentor fights the mentee with their little glowy shield protectors, which was a nice fight scene or whatever, but we're really just here to establish the shields, I think, for the most part, because that's going to be a device that we're going to need to see going forward, and, you know, understand that the young apprentice may have to face some true battles in the future, and is he up to the task?
Yeah, and because you have that stuff going on where you're kind of mentally comparing these things, I found it, like you said, a little distracting at times in terms of being fully in the moment of what's happening on screen. And I couldn't figure out if I was comparing stuff too harshly because of my overfamiliarity with the original stuff, or if I was accurate in my assessment of some negative thoughts I may have about the way certain scenes unfolded. But
I mean, I did the same thing. Is that our failing, or is that because the movie hews too closely to the previous adaptation? Like, what do we attribute that to? Is it just like we can't watch this movie because we've been ruined by previous Dunes?
Well, that's the real thing to think about. No, I don't think that is the case. I would say that the issue for me is that, like I was saying, in terms of what I viewed as the challenge facing Denis, it's whether or not he could do a better job of adapting what the emotions of the characters are and what the stakes of these situations are, because Lynch went about adapting it in terms of giving you these big exposition dumps of characters saying things either in the scene, or more often than not through voiceover, or through the addition of certain other scenes, like when the Emperor is talking to the third stage guild navigator and he explains the whole plot of the movie. That sort of thing is absent from this, where there is no unfolding of what the threat is, what the plan is. 'Cause it seems like the Duke is walking into a trap, but we don't know why it is a trap. The movie has a few lines in here about the Emperor being a very jealous man, and he wants to, you know, crush House Atreides by maneuvering this stuff against House Atreides. But it is a different thing of not having it. You don't have the exposition, but you replace it sort of with this vagueness about stuff. So it's, you know, at least for me and for you, you know, the betrayal is coming, and you know that sort of the bare mechanics of what's happening. I know for you that you don't remember all the like the houses of Lanzarote and blah 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 blah. Like you don't give two craps about that kind of thing. But that kind of stuff is absent from this. So instead, it just sort of is like, well, Leto's walking into a trap. He seems apprehensive about it, but he's gonna go do it, and then he's worried. He's worried the trap's happening, and then the trap happens. And it's like, okay, well, I guess, but why did the trap happen?
He's mad that he's the only one playing by the rules, and he's getting screwed, basically. Which, you know, it's a very... I thought Oscar Isaac did a good job for what he was given, but it's a very one-dimensional character for him to play. This sort of, you know... very straight-laced, kind of always do the right thing, noble character who, even in the face of people threatening to backstab him, just forges forward, you know. When they go low, we go high.
Oh, God.
That's basically his MO.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he ends up naked in a chair getting murdered.
Yeah. Well, when they go low, we go desert power. So
desert power. Got that was it. Not something he needed to like softly mutter under his breath there towards the end of the movie.
No, he just keeps saying it a lot. But but that's one of those things where it's like, if you're making this movie in 2021, do you see the challenge as changing these elements of the story so that you can bring in characters, you can make the characters in the story have these discussions about what's going on in a less oblique way? Or do you instead have everybody talk about it obliquely, even in the new scenes that you're adding, because you don't want to get into the nitty-gritty details of what the specifics are in terms of the great houses of the Landsraad and like the emperor and his popularity and blah, 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 blah. And you want to, I guess, maybe Denny wanted it to seem like more of a surprise. And maybe if you were a novice to this, if you had no familiarity with any of this stuff, maybe you would be more surprised, I suppose. But everybody's kind of talking about the fact that something's going to happen. And Paul has visions of the future. So I don't know what that necessarily gains you, because it doesn't seem like it'd be a surprise at that point.
Paul has visions of the future repeatedly that are all incorrect, which is, you know, at a certain point where the old lady with the box, the hand box, mm-hmm. says, you know, do you often have dreams of things that happen just as you dream them? And he said, not really. Like, eventually we know that every time that there's a slow motion cutaway to one of his dreams, we just know to like think the opposite of whatever we're seeing here, because we've seen it enough times that he's wrong. Like, the scene's right, but it's backwards or whatever. So, well, just do the thing backwards.
But the reason for that, and this is confusing, is because he can see possible futures, not just the future. So,
oh, yeah, we get that, but yeah. Like, you know, they only show us the wrong ones, so we just know that it's going to be something like this, but probably the opposite.
Yeah, well, I only really found it confusing when we got to the part towards the end where before he has the knife fight and he seemed to like have that moment of him being buddies or friends with the guy he has to kill.
Right, the guy who says, like, I'll teach you the ways of the desert and stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That was a little disorienting in terms of trying to place what the point of that was in terms of this movie, other than it's showing that they could have, under different circumstances, work together, I suppose. But the movie, there doesn't really seem to be any like repercussion from his decisions or anything, or how that could have been a possible future if they were always going to have this fight, or how he could have avoided the fight. I don't know. It's weird. And then there's also the issue of when you choose to end the movie, which kind of abruptly leaves out some of the things that you saw in these visions. So presumably they're for part two. Spoiler alert, they are for part two.
Which visions specifically do we not see occur here?
When he has that vision of him fighting in that weird like gold armor thing, and all the Fremen coming up out of the sand and killing a bunch of people. Like, that stuff is for the other part, when we flash forward a little and they're, you know, the Fremen are sort of this terrorist army that's rebelling against the Harkonnen oppressors. So that is it's not something we saw in this movie because it hasn't happened yet, but it is something that happens in the vision. Also, when we see Jessica as the Sayyidina, the Reverend Mother, of the siege, where she has those face tattoos and the blue eyes, and the baby with the blue eyes, that doesn't happen in this film, but that happens as we
see,
know.
Honestly, that was so disconnected from anything else. I was like, what is this weird vision? I don't need this.
Yeah. And I have to say, I didn't agree with some of the editorial choices of when to put those visions in. Again, because it's sort of disorienting when it happens. And a scene that I felt was really kind of working in terms of the adaptation was when Paul goes to meet the Reverend Mother for the first time. I mostly liked what he was doing with this adaptation, up until he started injecting the flash forward bits of the future stuff that he's seeing as these little fragments in between. And then the music swells to have this like choral, you know, vocal component to it, where it just doesn't match. It takes you out of this it takes you out of the danger of the situation Paul is currently in, because now it is about something prophetic that is going on outside of him. And then the scene returns to it just being about what's happening in that scene, which is a disagreement that I would make, you know, with Denis in terms of what he was choosing to process in that scene. In terms of movie making, it just kind of throws you out of what was dangerous about that.
Well, okay, so let's take an even larger step back, and let me ask you, what do you think is the purpose of the continued dream flashback, flash forward fantasy stuff? Like, in the beginning of the movie, when he's sleeping and has the dreams and we see the future stuff, like, we understand that there's an implication there. We understand that that's partly related to his, you know, training and stuff and him being the one or whatever. What is the utility of continuing to do that throughout the movie if those flash forwards don't really help us in a plot type way? Like, I guess before the final knife fight, we can sort of assume that he's like watching the moves the other guy is doing and trying to learn from them so he doesn't get killed, is kind of what they were implying. I think either that, or it was just like, you know, he was sad watching himself die, and then, you know, he's gonna do the opposite because it's one potential future and he's a real good fighter and stuff. But I can't think of a reason why we needed so many of the continued flash forward dream sequences throughout the movie to continually reinforce the fact that he's special and has these dreams. Like, we get it from the beginning part of the movie, and we don't necessarily need it for the rest of it.
I would say it's important to show that it's building over time. However, the things that he's having visions of are frequently the same. And he does have visions.
It's a slow motion close up shot of Zendaya.
Yeah,
you know,
turning towards camera in the sun behind her. Yeah,
and, yeah. And then a couple times they try to kiss, and then one time she stabs him. Great, cool.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because I think that it really sort of deflates, like I was saying with the Reverend Mother scene, it deflates the moments of what's actually happening linearly in the story, because now you're like trying to think about what's happening with these flashbacks, flash forwards, and the flash forwards don't always depict things that are happening, and they have a sort of distracting musical sound quality to them that takes you out of the scene. But it is still necessary to have them. I would say perhaps you could show fragments of them with him in the scene, not like crank the wailing vocals to 11 like Hans Zimmer was doing, to just sort of like have a brief glimpse of something, as opposed to these sort of like longer lingering shots of like Zendaya turning around in slow motion. So I don't really understand necessarily the point of why those were increasingly longer and longer takes of things that were not really happening. Because it doesn't increase communication about him having a vision, because we got it. So I don't know. Yeah. But it's challenging in terms of how you're going to depict that stuff. It's weird too. At least I think it's strange whenever a character has a flash forward that's supposed to be from their point of view, but it's from outside of their body because it's the camera crew, obviously. And so he sees things that are not what he sees. He sees things that us, the omniscient audience, sees. But, you know, that's a movie making gripe of mine that has very little to do with most people's appreciation of the film. I just wish those were handled better, because, like I said, it really kind of like kicks you out of whatever's happening whenever they were doing it in the film.
Well, okay, so let's a little bit of source material clarification before we keep going down the story. Just for my sake, can you remind me the purpose of this one character and his motivation? And you know, he's so you got your Bene Gesserits or whatever. They're only supposed to have girls, but she had a boy because she thought she could make this prophesied fancy Bene Gesserit guy who's gonna do something to help some people or something.
Well, I think the move
is he just there to bring balance to the Force? Like, what is he supposed to do?
Well, the Reverend Mother spells it out, but you know, you may not. It may not have sank in for you in that moment.
I heard it, but it went over my head.
Yeah,
let it go.
The Bene Gesserit have been conducting a breeding program where, through thousands and thousands of years, they've been arranging the order in which certain bloodlines are crossed and what progeny is produced from that, what they wind up doing, and then trying to cross those bloodlines again. And one of the ways they would do that is you would have a daughter in some situations. And in this particular situation, the Reverend Mother, you know, is upset because she was supposed to have a girl, because the girl could have been married to a Harkonnen, to have us have this situation occur. I don't know how they would have married, but they didn't feel like it was time for the Quisart Sadarak to show up, that it wasn't Jessica's call to make on that front. But in the process of torturing Paul, she realizes that it is possible that Paul is the Quisart Sadarak. So she doesn't want to kill Paul, but she's not 100% sure on all this stuff. She has doubt, because it's not completely clear. Like, the kid could just be talented or something.
Mm-hmm. And remind me again, though, like, what is the Quisart Sadarak supposed to do?
Okay. The Quisart Sadarak is supposed to be able to see through space and time. And that is one of the characteristics Paul displays here. And the important part of that is that he can can see all possible futures to know which path to sort of guide people on or to go on himself. And that is something that is very challenging for people, because the guild navigators can kind of do that, because that's how they get from one star system to another without, like, flying into objects. But they are not, like, normal people at the point where they're capable of doing that, because they've ingested so much spice and are all, like, strung out on spice.
Oh, that was in the first movie, right? Or the Lynch movie.
Yeah. And so that is not really an avenue for humans to go down, that's very durable. But Paul will be able to process all of this stuff. And there's also something else about the Bene Gesserit, which is not something she talks about here, but there is a process that you can go through that unlocks the genetic memories of all of your predecessors, which is some 1965 baloney. Where, you know, you'd be able to take some drug and then you would have the genetic memories of all of the people who came before you unlocked. And that's something that the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mothers do, so that they have access to knowledge that all of the other previous Reverend Mothers had. And if Paul were to ever do that, then he would be able to see into all the possible futures and through time, and he would also have all of the knowledge of everybody who came before him, so he'd be better at trying to figure out what path humanity should take in terms of guiding humanity into a better future. And so it's kind of important, but you'd have to be really committed to believing that this plan was possible in order to do all this stuff. These machinations are a little convoluted if you're just like, well,
fairly glossed over, especially in this adaptation.
Right. Cause it's like, oh yeah, on a lark, we're going to breed people for thousands of years until we produce somebody who can see the past and the future.
On a lark. You know, one thing, for better or worse, at least the Matrix, you know, harped on the powers of the One in a way that we could understand. And they said them enough times that we understood them. Here, we're just sort of like, he's going to do good stuff because he's the Messiah guy that's going to rescue everyone. And everyone's like, nah, you're not the dude. He's like, I don't know if I'm the dude or not, but I got these weird visions.
Yeah. And well, there's also another added complexity to it being Paul.
Of course there is.
Because Paul is the son of Duke Leto Atreides, which puts him in a different political position because that house has been destroyed now. Puts him in a different like vengeance position personally. Puts him in a different like power position of him being with the Fremen, and what he will do with and for them. And
it's like, what if Pontius Pilate killed Jesus's dog and then you got John Wick Jesus?
Well,
exactly.
Yeah. You just go ahead and pitch that one to
that's Dune. That's what it is.
Mel Gibson.
You get the sand and everything already.
Mm-hmm.
Hates you got your revenge. You got your revenge Messiah. Like he wants to help all the people that want to be helped, but also, you know, you killed my father, prepare to die or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's an ecological component to this. Again, I'm saying,
of course,
because the book is really dense. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of stuff in it. And one of the ecological components is that, the Fremen would like to have water, please. And they would like to have a planet that they can control, with an environment that is less harsh and better for them. But because of the circumstances of exploitation that they're under, they can't do that themselves. So that is another thing.
There's water under the surface and they were going to go get it, but then they discovered the spice and they're like, eh, hold on, let's keep the planet dusty, full of spice and stuff. Was that in the Lynch movie?
They revealed that there are caches of water that the Fremen have kept inside of these sieges underground, but that they haven't released them. But then at the end of the movie, Paul makes it rain. So it's a little different and weird. But yeah,
I just don't remember the, like, here's a factory that was on the verge of, bringing water up for people to live off of. And we had to shut that down because of, capitalism.
No, it was like it was some caves in the siege, where there were pools of water. And there's like a close up on a water drop. So it was nothing like super special in the Lynch version, but there's,
well, they can't do that here because then they couldn't do all the weird, gross spitting and stuff.
Right. Well, the important part of what they're saying here is that the water is there to terraform the planet. Should they choose to do that. And what they do not mention is that they don't terraform the planet because, the water is lethal to the sandworms. If you get rid of this, and they also don't go into where the spice comes from, because the spice is from the sandworms, basically.
Yeah, spice is dead worm, isn't it? Or is it worm poop?
I think it's worm afterbirth, technically.
Oh, okay.
Because they have what they call
placenta.
The little makers, which are the little baby worms, And then there's an explosion of spice that comes up to the surface from them, I guess, doing their biological functions. But that spice is, you know, necessary financially for and also, you know, logistically for the Empire to function. So they can't get rid of the spice.
So weird, and I don't want to derail this train of thought, but like the idea that the Emperor is mad at Leto and sends him there as sort of like a trap to get killed by the Harkonnens because they know they're going to be pissed that they got booted after 80 years and they want their power and their money back, so they're going to fight for it, and they're going to basically invade. The Emperor is just going to like turn a blind eye to the fact that the Harkonnens are abandoning the orders that they were given and they're fighting the Atreides just because they felt like it.
But it's not just a blind eye. He helps them. He gives them 3 legions of Sardaukar.
Sure, but like he's doing all this and putting the spice production stuff at risk, at least for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially, if this war goes badly, like, and both sides are kind of crippled, or the city and infrastructure, which is kind of blown up and destroyed, like you're kind of putting a damper on one of your super important things that you got here. So seems real, real petty and short-sighted for whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah, you would think that. But the emperor is pretty confident that if anything happens to the House Harkonnen and they can't, you know, mine spice, or mine spice fast enough, the Emperor can always just take it over, because at that point, the House Harkonnen is not going to be in a position to fight the Emperor. But that is, you know, not really the point of this plot. The Emperor is mainly threatened by Duke Leto Atreides being too popular, and that there is potential for him to be usurped by a more popular guy.
And I realize it would defeat the purpose of the story, but I think the methods by which he's trying to remove Leto from, you know, his position of popularity is the dumbest possible way he could go about it.
Well, it is a way that allows the Emperor to deny involvement, because if the Emperor just attacked Duke Leto Atreides, then he'd have to deal with all of the other houses rising up against the Emperor, saying, hey, no, you can't do that. That's not allowed. Because then you could just do that to any one of us, so we're all going to join forces together against you. Whereas, if he has House Harkonnen do it for him, then it is a spat between the two houses, which are famously acrimonious, and it has nothing to do with the Emperor. So he has clean hands.
But the idea that, like, the Harkonnens are obey the Emperor enough to leave when he says leave, but are rebellious enough to go back and start a war on their own, and the Emperor says nothing, like, I find it difficult to believe that people wouldn't be able to put two and two together and go, like, oh, I see this was the plan all along.
Yeah, well, the Baron is
also... Maybe that's just my 2021 movie-watching cynicism or something, but, like, you know.
Well, the Baron is also kind of... Well, not kind of, but he has designs of his own for stuff. So he's not... I would say that the Baron is not a fool in terms of accepting this help from the Emperor in this situation. I would say that the Emperor's a fool for going through with this, but that's, you know, a different thing. But, you know, rich and powerful people who get into positions of power frequently panic if something threatens their power, and they do some irrational stuff that doesn't really seem like it was worth doing. So, you know, it's one of those situations. And since everything is, you know, this monarchy situation that you're dealing with, is these fiefdoms, it's a different kind of political structure than what, you know, we would be familiar with in the modern era. So it is not the kind of thing where they can be questioned about in terms of inside of their own organizations as much as it is, like, whether or not they have loyalty and fealty to the Emperor.
I guess, sort of, you know, to make a long story short with this whole conversation, is that there's a lot of hats on these hats.
Mm-hmm.
And
plans within plans. Hats within plans.
Yeah. What for the purpose of this motion picture product is the story here that we are meant to take away, and what are we supposed to focus on? Because, again, there's a whole lot of junk here that we could be just talking about and stuff, but for the purposes of a movie, we kind of need a perspective and a goal and a plot to get us there. And, you know, it seems pretty Paul-centric, but also there's a lot of other stuff happening here. And, you know, Chalamet's good and all, but, you know, he just kind of makes angsty teen faces a lot and says some snide things from time to time. And even some fairly cliched dialogue at points where it was just like, really, that was the simplest or most straightforward way you could say it? Like, I mean some of the dialogue was just dumb, you know. It was like, oh, I see how it is, Mom, really just using me over here.
Yeah, there's some disappointment with the modernization of some of the dialogue, because the dialogue from the 1965 book is very clunky, and there are bits of that original writing that are brought through to this adaptation, as well as in...
Is that the extremely Shakespearean dialogue?
Yeah, it's very florid, the stuff that is going on. But then all of a sudden, you can tell when they added something that's not from the original, because then it is much more, like you said, angsty teen, where it is unlike the writing style of the other stuff, but it is. I would say in terms of what this story is about, it's about Paul, largely, but Paul intersects with all of these other things. So if you had a Venn diagram, all of the other circles have a little overlap with Paul, and that Paul is the important part of this the process. Now, for the audience, I feel like there are different ways of approaching that situation, because there are things about Paul that are not discussed in the film that are kind of important, or will be important. So it'll be interesting to see what they choose to do with the second part, because maybe some of those things that are missing from this first part will be in the second part. But it is odd.
It's weird to just have such a mystical coming of age story dab smack in the middle of such a complicated political war story, I think. I mean, again, I keep coming back to The Matrix because there's probably a lot of similarities there, but like somehow, well, I was going to say somehow they did it more clearly and better, but not really if you look at it on the 3-movie scale.
Well, yeah, I would say if you just look at the first film, that's a totally different discussion. Yeah. I don't want to compare it to The Matrix because that's a whole other kettle of fish, but the situation with this film in terms of like clarity is that perhaps some clarity could be brought in terms of I hate to say explain some of these other things more, but
is it expectations? Is it like what should we as the audience expect to get out of this if things go well?
Well, but that's more of a problem, I think, with how they ended this part one. Because there isn't a build up to Paul getting something, or there isn't a goal that is achieved so much. They get to the Fremen group. There's a knife fight and he goes with the Fremen. That's it. That we're done. Story's yeah. over. He's with Johnny. That's it.
The achievement in this particular movie is that they managed to not die in the desert long enough to be rescued-ish, sort of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I would have preferred is that even if you're ending it part of the way through the book, I would have preferred you end it with Paul in the siege realizing that he has plans to strike back and what he's going to do. Rather than...
So you just want one more scene where it's a very slow dolly push in to Paul and he's looking down at the ground and then looks up with sort of like angry, dedicated eyes.
No, but I would suggest that you could remove the scene from Seleucus Secundus entirely if you needed to add something that made the movie better.
You said those words like I had any idea what those are.
Seleucus Secundus was the emperor's planet that he trains the Sardaukar on, or well, he doesn't do it, but the Sardaukar are on Seleucus Secundus, and that's that scene where we see Peter DeVries, what's his name, David Dusmalkin, who is there on the planet, saying, "Oh yeah, we agreed to have legions of your troops or whatever." And it's I know why Denny wanted to show it because it allows for world building, but that's not inherently anything important for the story of Paul and what we're doing in terms of telling that story. So it has neat visual things that are going on that show us the extreme nature of the Sardaukar, which was, I guess, something, you know, depending on what you think about it, is pretty absent from the Lynch version. But
it's really just our indication that the Emperor is in on it, right? Because he's loaning some troops for them to go kick everyone's butt.
Yeah, but why did we need to have 5 minutes on Seleucus Secundus instead of having 5 minutes where Paul says, you know, I'm going to strike back at them at the end of the film? Like,
we didn't need to see it. I mean, it could have been a line of dialogue. The whole, like, just give me 3 legions or whatever, and like, you know, we're the toughest in the universe or whatever, so everyone that fights us dies, so by bringing us to the party, then you're definitely going to win, but also you're beneath us with your demands or whatever the hell that conversation was.
Yeah, and also, unfortunately, I have to say, in terms of things that are like here to flesh out stuff, the scene with Paul where he meets Duncan Idaho after he does that flying fighter thing on Caladan, that didn't fill me with joy. I don't know really why that was there.
When he did which thing on what now?
Remember when Jason Momoa, as Duncan Idaho, lands his little jet fighter craft on Caladan, the water planet the Atreides are from, at the beginning of the movie, and Paul is there, and he greets Duncan Idaho, and he's talking to him, and he tells Duncan about his dream, and says, please take me with you to go on the early scouting party. That whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like that scene was executed well, because I don't care about Duncan Idaho, which is fundamentally an issue, because they have a lot of Jason Momoa as Duncan Idaho in this film, for reasons that I'm assuming are contractual, because I don't know what the focus on him really gained for us in the audience. But that is something. Now,
he's a tough soldier and a role model,
I guess. But like, in terms of if you're adapting this work and you're trying to choose what's important and how to make people feel like there are clear goals and clear places we're going, I wish they were more clear with all of the characters that were in Paul's life. Like Dr. Yui, who is the family doctor who is, you know, trained with Imperial training so that he can't be broken by anything, is supposed to be what that stupid diamond on his forehead is supposed to represent. But they don't talk about any of like his conditioning or any of that. They don't talk about why he could be above suspicion. So his betrayal doesn't seem any more interesting later on. He's also not really a character. He gives people some pills. He touches Paul on his shoulders and his forehead and says, you know, take two of these and call me in the morning. It is not fleshed out. And so his betrayal also doesn't feel ultimately that earned.
No. He's only there for the false tooth.
Right. The false tooth, nothing but the tooth.
Was that in the first, the Lynch movie?
Yeah. The false tooth is in every version. Something that was different about this is he bites down on, I believe in the book and in the Lynch version, the Duke kind of can't see clearly because of the sedative that was used on him. And so when Peter DeVries leans in over him, he bites down on the tooth and exhales on it, and it kills Peter DeVries. Whereas in this version, he does it to the Baron directly. There's no doubt about that. But the Baron just manages to survive because his like hover spine took him up to the ceiling, instead of being down on the bottom of the room with everybody else breathing in poison. Because I guess the poison, you know, has an altitude that it can reach.
Yeah, it weighs more than oxygen, so it's like dry ice on the ground.
Right. And in the other versions, it doesn't like kill everyone in the room. It was very dramatic. But that is in the versions. It is kind of important that Yui is not like, he's a fool for believing the Baron would stop torturing his wife for anything short of death. Or that betraying the Atreides would get him what he really wanted. But he at least had this backup plan that does throw a very small wrench into things, which is a good wrinkle to have. But Yui himself, why we care about him, is a little absent from this. And, you know, I know that this is a 2-hour, 35-minute movie. And so where do you put in this stuff? And it's like, I don't know, man. But like, that's the challenge of adapting this, is just like, if you're going to have these characters, I want to care about the characters. I don't want the characters to just show up. And then they do a thing and then they leave, or die, is more often the case. But
I mean, Jason Momoa spends the whole time like, hey buddy, we're good pals. I'll be off doing my own thing over here and I'll catch you later in five scenes.
Right. And like, Keynes, the Imperial ecologist judge of the change, dies in the original, but it's not the dramatic sandworm death thing. So, you know, it's kind of a more like badass death in terms of adapting it for this. But like, is that the wisest course of action when you have some underdeveloped character stuff to deal with, or, you know, unclear plot stuff? I don't know. And like, the Baron having his weird, like, I don't know, pleather insect pet thing. Like, did we need that versus anything else with the Baron? Like, the Stellan Skarsgård.
Sorry, did I have a stroke? Pleather insect pet?
Well, remember when the Emperor's Truthsayer, River Mother, goes to visit the Baron?
Yes, kinda.
Remember, she says that thing out of here, and there's like that multiple limbed thing on the floor, like drinking from a water bowl. Did you like blink or something?
I must have or something. I don't know. Well, it sounds vaguely familiar, but if it was just like the entrance to a scene, then I guess I didn't pay enough attention to it.
Yeah. Well, you guys should go back and watch that because it's strange. But like, that has nothing to really do with the book. And I get that Denis is trying to make the Baron seem strange and make the Baron weird and have this sort of, you know, fetish aspect to him, which in the book is, you know, his disgusting pederastic qualities and his affection towards young boys. And it's sort of depicted, well, not sort of, it is depicted in the Lynch version. But in this version, they went this weird route of like having a little spider creature thing. But the strangeness of adapting the Baron in this version is also, he has very little dialogue, and the Baron is such a theatrical character in the book, and in other adaptations of it, that I found that choice strange, because the Baron does a lot of like rumbly, I'm the Baron, I'm not gonna, my doom. And so it's, you know, a little lackluster for me in terms of those decisions, because we also don't get a sense of like really his cruelty, and his hatred of Duke Leto, and the family and all of that, and his aspirations. Everything's just so grumbly, that, I feel like that's absent from this adaptation as well.
Mm. A little bit too much of a Bond villain, and not, well, I guess kind of not the opposite of that. He doesn't speak up enough. Yeah, I get that, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know. But I feel like, you know, having said that, we should probably come to, you know, our famous final judgment section, where we talk about if this was a Dune bad movie.
A Dune movie, a bad Dune movie, or
Dune we kind of liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not in as few terms, but I would like to know how you feel about this movie in general. And let's like put it in direct comparison to the other one. Like, you know, are you gonna, if you have a fixin' for some Dune, you're gonna watch this one, you're gonna watch the other one? How are you feeling about the Dune?
Well, I kind of gave it away at the beginning when I said that I feel like they're both different. Would I be compelled to watch this movie again? Yeah. In fact, I started watching it again today at home for the portion of the beginning. I only got like 2 hours through, but
only 2 hours.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's important. Well, actually, no, it was an hour and a half, because there's still the other hour of them wandering around in a desert. But yeah, I would say that it's different, and I appreciated it more on the second viewing, I think, because I was less distracted by thinking about
scenes and things.
Yeah, I was less distracted about thinking about other things, in terms of what I could just more or less focus on what I was seeing, because I was sort of expecting the same stuff to unfold, and it did. So it was
It'd be weird if it didn't.
Well, that would be pretty funny, though. He doesn't kill the guy with a knife. So my feeling on this is that they're very different films and very different adaptations, and I don't see Lynch's version as a successful movie, as successful storytelling. My fascination with it is its weirdness and its, for lack of a different term, rough edges. It's sort of rushed incompleteness. It's mangled but, you know, opinionated qualities. Whereas I feel like this movie is smoother than that by a long shot. It is probably more streamlined in terms of telling the story that it's doing, but I don't feel like it brings me any closer to the source material that it's drawing from, and I don't feel like it has the bizarre stuff about the Lynch version that I appreciated. So its qualities of having atmosphere, of having scale, of having grandeur, of having this visual, like, enveloping quality of, like, look at everything all around us. That I appreciate, because it's absent, very absent from the Lynch version, where they just obviously could not do anything of the sort in 1984. We'll forever be sort of like juggling these two sort of incomplete things. I am looking forward to seeing the second half, just because I'm curious how it not only interfaces with this, but if it makes it feel like it's a more complete work. Because another thing that we haven't talked about is that Dune is a book series. There is the first book, Dune, and then there's a bunch of other books that come after it. And they all go, like if you thought this was dense and weird, oh boy, just you wait if they ever get around to adapting the other stuff. Will they end it in a place where it makes sense to end for that first book, or are they going to say, you know what, let's bring in something from the next book? Are they going to say, oh yeah, we're going to tease qualities to the next book that we're going to talk about, or something?
The Dune expanded universe.
Yeah, although I am less concerned with with Denis Villeneuve, because if anything, he's going to like get 3/4 of the way to the end of the book and just be like, oh no, I need another movie, and then we're gonna have like a Dune Part 3.
I feel like he's gonna lose interest, and I don't think Dune is gonna be the next Star Wars. I think it's gonna be 2 and out. They're pushing their luck with making this a 2-parter.
Well, it's also one of those things that's difficult to gauge. We'll talk about that in a second, because I want to hear what your opinion is before we get out of our get out of this segment. But it is, before we get into like the future, let's talk about how you currently feel about this. Like, do you want to revisit this? Do you hate this more or less than the Lynch version? Because you didn't like the Lynch version at all. So
yeah. So I think I would use a lot of the same words to describe the two movies as you just did, but you said they are different movies, and I will say they are the same movie with different visual styles, just based on the same descriptions. Like, the same stuff happens. So if I wanted to watch a Dune story, I feel like I could pick either one depending on just like whatever mood I was in, and I would get the same Dune story out of it. I would probably watch this one again because I like Denis and I like the things he does, and I enjoy the atmosphere that it brought to this particular story. Lynch's does feel rushed and chaotic, and like it feels like a Tim Burton Batman movie versus like a more modern Batman movie with Denis's version. I do think rewatching it would be a good thing to sort of get that first viewing, you know, that taste out of my mouth and just kind of watch it without the expectations. I don't know if I'm gonna do that because it's 2.5 hours long and it's Dune. But
yeah, who knows? Tin Cup might be playing on the TV. You don't want to miss that.
I haven't watched Tin Cup in so long. I feel like I need a palate cleanser of some Tin Cup. Hindsight, whatever. I'm sure I hated the Lynch movie more because it was just absolute nonsense and gave me a headache, and I just completely checked out halfway through because it's just ridiculous. I didn't check out in this movie. I was watching it. I was paying attention. because I like Denis' movies and I was trying, but at the same time, I don't give a crap about the story of this movie. I really don't. Like, I cannot for the life of me care about any of these people. I find it interesting in a sci-fi sense, and comparing it to, like, you know, I'm spending most of the time comparing it to, Blade Runner. Amanda compared it to Mad Max because there's a lot of sand. Like, there's a lot of weird sci-fi stuff going on in here that I end up thinking about. But, like, in terms of getting invested in a story, like, it doesn't grab me. But that's not surprising because, you know, weird sci-fi stuff doesn't really grab me like that. Unless you're talking about a really small scale, like Ex Machina style movie.
Yeah. Also, I would say that this is not science fiction so much as it is like a you know, fantasy kind of thing.
It's on the edge, right?
Yeah, because it is, you know, or soft science fiction, you could say. Like, there's sciency things in here, but it's
soft,
like,
sci-fi, hard fantasy.
It's like, you know, the stuff where you would explain, like, oh yeah, there's a that's all from a field generator that did that thing, and it made a shield that stuff goes slow through. And so there's sciency fictiony components to it, but it's mainly dealing with, like, oh, prophecies and humans adapted under extreme conditions in order to be able to present certain talents or attributes to do superhuman feats.
Yeah, Jesse Ziegler called it a space opera, which, sure, fine, whatever.
Yeah, it is. But the you know, these are just the categories that don't really appeal to you in general. And
it's if it's not so much the category, it's the scope. And, like, I realize the scope is part of the impressiveness of this, but
the, like, scope is least, the point.
The scope is the point. Yes. But, like, at least with Blade Runner, I feel like there was a large scope. There were large stakes, but they still managed to make a personal story that I was able to follow and invest in. And here, less so.
Yeah. I would say that I'm more disappointed with the adaptation of this than I am with 2049. But with 2049, I was annoyed with what they chose to do to end the picture because it made no sense. So that is something else different.
Sure.
And I don't really compare the two. It is interesting that Amanda compared it to Mad Max, because if George Miller directed Dune, if he did an adaptation of Dune, it'd be like 5 minutes long. They'd forget all of the stuff. It would all be out there.
Cocaine and adrenaline fueled Dune. Maybe that's what we need.
Yeah. I mean, it's just have everybody just, like, fight in the desert. Movie's over. So I could see as an interesting take to this. Do I think that there's anyone out there who could adapt this movie well, or sorry, adapt the book well into a movie? Do I think it's better as a mini series? Potentially, except I have been watching the Foundation miniseries on Apple TV Plus, and it is garbage. So you can always screw it up whenever you're adapting something. I don't think the format necessarily is your friend in any of these situations.
What is Foundation?
Oh, it's a Isaac Asimov. He's one of the old school sci-fi guys, very prolific author. Some negatives about him in terms of his personal life and his writing style, and again, also kind of writing things like technical manuals instead of, like, you know, characters and stuff. So there is a adaptation of his work in terms of making it into a series, but it is dreadful. And that's a bit of a letdown, because, you know, it's not that the format necessarily means that you can adapt the story better if you're trying to fit to what the modern restrictions on what a television series is. You know, so I don't necessarily.
But I had that same thought. I after the movie, I was thinking, should this have been a mini series? Would that allow us to pull apart these intertwined threads that are so dense and make it more episodic, so that we have, you know, more clear and short-term goals and stakes that we can achieve or fail at, and then move on to the next episode and deal with the next bit of it there. But I feel like the problem you would have is each of those episodes would be, you could probably make them self-contained. It would be a little difficult to separate the threads. But what you would end up with at the end is 8 hours of a story that just didn't fit together. You would have eight individual, you know, Dune extended universe novellas or whatever that just didn't stick together in a linear fashion to create one overall story. I don't think that would be any more successful. It would be coherent on a micro level, but the macro story would be just as convoluted and kind of lost on us.
Well, I disagree with that, because there are people who can follow. I think modern audiences are accustomed, because of the popular entertainment that is out there, that they can deal with these build-ups with these long, you know, convoluted stories over time, as long as the reward that you get at the end is good and the mystery that you're solving at the beginning is good. What the mystery of Dune is kind of isn't there, though. So that is interesting in terms of like how you dictate that. I wouldn't split every single thread into a separate episode, but then you run into sort of a problem that the Foundation series is having on Apple TV Plus, where they have episodes where they just drop a thread for a week then they pick it up the next week. And it's just like, how has this person been doing this thing for three weeks now? And it's because they just don't have storytelling
time. You would have to do some of the stuff to get to the specificity level of some of these threads. But, you know, you're going to come in on episode three and it's going to be like, last we saw Paul at the end of episode one, he was hiding in the desert and trying not to get stabbed. Here he is again, hiding in the desert and stuff.
Yeah. Like, and, you know, in terms of like adapting this to a miniseries, which is what the Sci-Fi Channel did, it was everything was a little clearer in terms of storytelling. But like I said, it was just a bad poorly adapted in terms of scope and scale and acting and everything. Like, it was not what it's the polar opposite of what Dune did. It had certain advantages in terms of what you could do in terms of storytelling, because it had more time, but not so much that it was a running series where you had to stretch out and pad things, or like, you know, pick up a thread and drop it the next week or something. So it's just a different set of challenges. And with our modern media landscape, I'm not sure why we can't come up with formats that are not, strictly speaking, a television series or a miniseries, with certain like predetermined, you know, run times and endpoints and things. Like, we, you know, if something needs to be like 45 minutes in order for it to make sense, make it 45 minutes. You know, if something needs to be an hour and a half, make it an hour and a half.
It's just about, you know, the people with the money. Like, how much money do you need from them, and how much are you going to promise back? Well, based on how much money movies bring in and how much money TV series bring in, blah, 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 blah. You know, just wait, 10 more years until the theatrical movie system is completely crippled and basically only reserved for Quentin Tarantino to show revival movies. And then we can get around to talking about stuff that doesn't necessarily fit the exhibition mold.
Yeah. Well, I would also say that in our lifetimes, we are definitely going to see another adaptation of Dune. But the maybe we'll get around to whatever it is then. But the financial incentives, which are a very important part of this storytelling process specifically, because Denis wanted to do this as two parts, and he could only get them to agree to give him the money to do the first part, because Blade Runner 2049 was a huge flop, and it was very expensive, huge flop. So because of that, he only got to make this portion of the film, and then they had to wait for a green light. And one thing that observers may have noticed this past week of it being released is that there was a bit of a pause, and we're like, why haven't people announced that they're making the second one? And it eventually came, where they made the announcement. And the reason why it took so long to come up with this announcement is because they financially needed to see if they were going to break even on this, and not only break even, but is there a potential that this will earn a profit? And what will the profit that it earns be worth it to make another one? you know, like what is the situation that you're going to be in? What are you going to put yourself through in order to make the second thing? And is it going to be worth your time and money doing it? And it is obviously a different landscape this year than anybody thought. This movie was supposed to come out last year. Delayed. And it was supposed to be like a normal-ish movie release where it has an exclusivity window for theatrical distribution. And then because of Warner Brothers trying to increase viewership of HBO Max, they threw everything that they were distributing for the calendar year of 2021 on HBO Max. And going forwards, they said they're not doing that in 2022. And so there's probably some language in the contract Legendary has with HBO, Warner, to make sure that they don't do that, where they don't put this on HBO Max again, and that it gets a theatrical window of X number of days, 45 probably, and that a situation also impacts the finances for the film. Because what happened with this one is they got a payout when everybody was all cranky because Warner had to make it right for all these people so they wouldn't get sued into oblivion. So they gave all these filmmakers money as if their movie had done well at the box office. And so they were going to get that no matter what. And now the movie has kind of done well, pretty well, for pandemic standards. And
it says gross worldwide, 223. That's pretty good.
Yeah, except that the movie cost $165 million to make, and that doesn't include the marketing budget and also remarketing the picture again or any of the other expenses. And I believe Legendary put up 80% of the funding to make the film. So Legendary really needs to make a lot of money off of this because nobody's making a blockbuster to break even. So it's interesting just to think about the mechanics of that and whether and how that impacts making a sequel. And now that the sequel's greenlit and they're going to make it, and it's supposed to, I believe, come out in 2023, that process that we get from that may potentially produce other, you know, other movies in a series. Maybe Denis doesn't do them. Maybe he hands off the torch to somebody else. Who knows? Like you know, Tim Burton to Joel Schumacher. Who's going to be Denis' Joel Schumacher?
Let's see who does very bad sci-fi impersonation movies.
Roland Emmerich.
Michael Bay.
Paul W.S. Anderson.
Paul W.S. Anderson could make this movie for $30 million.
And it would look like it.
yes, of course.
The hydraulics guys, those guys, they could do it.
Yeah. Boy. Were they the Skyline ones or the other one?
The Skyline
Battle
ones.
Los Angeles.
Yeah. They made Battle Los Angeles for Sony, and then they made Skyline on the side.
Then they got in trouble because they were reusing some models or something, right?
Yeah. Sony's like, hey, you made the same movie that we made and sued them. And then they settled. So anyway, ridiculous. But
Must have been an okay settlement because they're still in business, aren't they?
Presumably. I mean, I haven't seen them do anything like major in a while, but it doesn't really matter. There's also a television series. I think it's called like Dune Sisterhood or something. And it is
the traveling sisterhood of the Dune pants.
yeah, the traveling sisterhood of the still suit pants. But something that's been in development for a while, and then the person who was developing it, John Safitz, who was left to go write the sequel to Dune, part of the way through the process, and they have to bring in a different showrunner. And I think that happened back in February before they had the official green light, obviously, on making a sequel. But the that series is supposed to be about the Bene Gesserit, you know, hundreds of years prior to the events of this film. And so I think that there is a desire with Legendary and with Warner and with all parties financially interested and involved to continue to make stuff and put it out there that has to do with Dune, which is a different kind of situation to be in from 1984, because you just you didn't make movies and television shows and cinematic universes like that back then.
Feels like a lot of grand DC universe type plans that I don't see unfolding. But what do I know? Maybe the market out there for Dune content is so hot that we'll be getting a new Dune movie every year, like Star Wars is.
Well, what's curious about, I'm surprised, I don't know if you are, I'm surprised by the general reaction to the release of this film. Mm-hmm. It has been, I would say, overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah.
And in ways that I would have not really expected. I am curious to see how much of that has to do with people's sort of pent-up demand for a reason to go to the local cinema.
No. I think if it's anything, it's because people know and like Denis, and this had a very large star-studded cast of people that everyone recognized. And I think Chalamet's got some current star power that really brings in the kids. He's got that sad face he makes, and he's got the hair, and people want to see him do stuff.
Yeah, where he kind of looks down at the ground, but then like raises his pupils up, so he's sort of like looking up underneath the brows, mm-hmm. of his deep set eyes. Yeah,
yeah. I really thought that was poor strategy in that final knife fight where he had the hair completely in front of his face. Like, that's not a good way to see what's happening as somebody's about to attack you with a weapon.
Yeah, he's a living Tim Burton cartoon, but he
kind of.
I don't think he was fine, but I don't think he brought like anything super special to this. I liked Rebecca Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But
she looked sad and cried a lot. So yeah,
I didn't like all the anxious stuff they gave her to do. I was like, she's this like super powerful badass. Like, you let her be a little more, you know, super powerful badass, I think. Yeah. But the other thing, just in terms of casting is, I don't know if you've noticed, but Zendaya is in the promotional materials for Dune, a lot. Like a ton, like a whole big old bucket load of Zendaya in all of the promotional materials. Every poster, trailer, everything has Zendaya in it. She's mentioned, she is top billing in this movie for some reason. And, it is very curious how little of the movie she's in. And, Jason and I saw a friend over the weekend who had seen the movie, and she was surprised and upset and didn't actually really like the film. She said she started falling asleep, but then Hans Zimmer's score would always keep waking her back up again. And she didn't understand why Zendaya was barely in the movie. And I was like, well, that's because Chani's not really in that first part of the book. And so she's not really in the film very much, but they want you to go see the film. So they talk about her character and her casting a whole lot, even though she's not really in it. And I think LA Times did some sort of like they counted it up, and she has 7 minutes of screen time in the film, in the two-hour 35-minute film that she's heavily advertised as being in.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I heard that too. I mean, I understand that because her part of the story is in part two, but what are you gonna do? It's not the most scandalous thing that could have happened.
No, I don't think it's a huge scandal, but it's curious how many people are like, I love this movie. It was great. I thought it could never be adapted, and it was adapted, and it's wonderful. And it's like, what would you watch? That's why I was curious if it's just like, is it just the visual impact of this? Is it just, you know, being immersed in it that is what's driving people to say these things? Because I don't know. I don't really have the same compulsion to praise it without reservation.
I mean, it just feels like a version of Dune where they had all of the resources that they wanted, and they made the thing that they were trying to make, and they put a lot of money and effort into it. Like, it wasn't hamstrung by the same sort of production issues the Lynch version had. It wasn't a made-for-TV movie. They really they put a lot of wood behind this arrow, and people can appreciate it for a well-constructed film, despite the fact that it is Dune nonsense.
Yeah, and I feel like there is an interesting discussion about the film from three other, I think they're all critics, but I know David Sims is, at The Atlantic. They have The Review podcast. And it was interesting because there's three people on the podcast, and one of them loved it, one of them didn't like it, and one of them was in between. And I don't know if they had coordinated that beforehand or what, but it was interesting to hear them explain to each other why the other one was wrong because they liked the thing that the other one didn't like, or they didn't like the thing the other one liked. So
that's the beauty of that scene that you hated, because it did all of these things that subverted expectations.
Yeah.
I want my expectations not subverted. I don't know.
Yeah. Feel like you and I have more or less similar feelings, although with different intensities of dislike. But you know, I would say it's a mostly similar assessment. So if you're somebody for some reason who like really thought that this adaptation was the bee's knees, I think you should be listening to a different podcast, but maybe you could start there. Another thing that I also liked, listeners, if you're interested, is that there is someone who has a dreaded Substack. I think it's called Max Reed. I don't know. We'll put the link down in the thing. The guy went through and did a annotation of stuff from the film that you kind of need to know, or, you know, loosely comparing things. It's not super dense, and it's written in a humorous way, so that it can be more approachable to the layman about what's going on and why you would care about certain stuff, and, you know, how stuff could have is depicted in the book differently from how it's depicted here, or shortcomings of the book's description of things. Because, you know, also keep in mind, the book, again, was written in 1965. It's, you know, got psychedelic space religion stuff, and it's got, you know, your ecological stuff, and it's got your some of that. Well, not some. It has quite a bit of just sort of taking a lot of stuff from the Middle East, Levant area, and just saying, like, what if we had the Fremen? And they're kind of like, you know, just sort of this conglomeration of, you know, this desert. These sort of, like, you know, exoticized desert-dwelling thing. And so... Mm-hmm. You know, there are critiques to be made of this stuff in terms of the original source material.
Honorable desert people that have their own special customs and history and things.
Right. Yeah. It's and to say that it's a bit of a trope in Hollywood at this point is, you can definitely mention it, but it is something that's probably, it definitely merits further discussion. I don't feel like the movie itself goes as hard or weird into that stuff, but we didn't really spend much time with the Fremen, so we'll see how Denis handles it next time. You know, so tune in two and a quarter years from now, or whatever, 2.5 years from now, whenever we talk about the next one.
Oh yeah, I saw on IMDb when I was scrolling down looking for the budget, there were two related news articles. Dune Part 2 is already far along in development, could shoot next fall. I don't know how far along in development it is if they're going to shoot in a year, but well, okay.
Denis is much more of a planning director than some of the other directors are. Like, he's not a guy who's going to start shooting with the third act of the script missing, you know, and he likes to storyboard. Well, I don't know if he storyboards everything, but he definitely likes to have the concepts nailed. He likes to have the stuff built. He likes to know what it is that he's going into. And he may make editorial decisions later, which are different, but he doesn't approach the directing process as sort of like a, hey, what are we doing here? Let's explore the space. You know, so it's something where I could believe they'll spend a lot of time in pre-production and then just be like, okay, yeah, we're ready now. Let's go. Mm.
The other related news article right next to that says, Denis Villeneuve thinks Christopher Nolan is a master, doesn't consider himself on that level.
Well, that's because Christopher Nolan heaped a bunch of praise on Denis Villeneuve and said that he had integrated, it was one of the, I forget what Christopher Nolan's exact words were, but he had done the best integration of visual effects and live action that he's ever seen.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, this is not accurate, but...
Denis definitely deserves the credit for that also.
Yes, right. Specifically just him. I would say that there is the technical stuff that we didn't really talk about in terms of this movie. Like the visual effects house that did this is predominantly Dineg. I think they did a good job with largely with everything. There are some nits to pick and some things, but like I don't care enough to nitpick those nits.
Well, Jesse did ask what you think of the dragonfly copters.
So in the book, the thopters are these things that have wings that literally beat like in the air. I always thought that was silly just in terms of like a literary thing. So I never really wanted to see them. Never really wanted to see it depicted on screen, but seeing it on screen, it's like, yeah, well, I mean, it looks kind of neat. Like I like the motion blur and the wings and stuff. So, you know, it looks like you got these little dragonflies, basically.
And the way they rotate, kind of tuck in like, didn't there used to be helicopters that would sort of do that kind of thing?
Maybe. I'm not a huge helicopter buff, but yeah, they're like, you know, dragonfly helicopters. And I did like that they had a visual language that made it distinct between the Atreides thopters that they had that were all angular and pointy and the Harkonnen ones, which were kind of like bloated and round. And then the Fremen, like old school one that they had in that Imperial ecology, like terraforming center that they use as their escape craft.
I definitely noticed that there was a difference between the three of them.
Yeah, they were all very different. But so, you know, I think that it's interesting to see those things. Do I consider them to be something that I would have sought out or desired? Like, had they just shown us, like, little jet planes in the movie, would I have cared? Not really. Because it's just, you know, when you start to really think about, like, the logistics of having something that, like, flaps big metal wings in order to propel the aircraft through the air, it's just a little odd. But it does give this franchise a visual distinction that separates it from other things, which is also something that I think is nice when you start to compare like this to your other big franchises like Star Wars or Marvel stuff or whatever. Like things more or less felt like they had weight to them. The choice to go with like these little missiles that have the, you know, trails from the like burning propellants inside of them, you know, and things that are like bombs but like can like spin through shields slowly, like all that stuff made this feel unique and not like other things we've seen with shields where like bolts are just like bouncing off or whatever. So it made it distinct enough, I would say, from other science fiction things.
Yeah, sure. The universe.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with the metaverse.
No. No, it's better than the metaverse. Because you definitely want to live on Arrakis, because it just seems so appealing.
I mean, it's better than living in Facebook.
That's true. God, could you imagine? So who's gonna rise up and rebel over there inside of the virtual metaverse? This has been a prophecy.
John and Jane Doe, who are then going to get sued into oblivion because of Mark's lawyers.
Probably. But anyway, yeah, we think we covered everything we can say about the film as it stands at the moment. There's technical things about the different release aspect ratios stuff or whatever, but we haven't gone around and sampled every version of the film we could watch.
Yeah. I wish I could remember what episode we did our tirade on how stupid it was to shoot digital and then print it to film and then rescan that back in, but we did talk about that, and I will just restate briefly, it was extremely stupid and in no way helps the look of this film. I don't know why they wasted the time and money doing that.
Yeah, I would say it's not apparent that they did that versus any other approach. And I will say that...
The end third of the movie is extremely dark, by the way. For a little while, I thought my TV was like screwing up and like calibrated wrong or something, because it was very dark.
Yeah, I don't know. But the more of a time of day choice, I guess. But the purposeful degradation of the image is not something you really needed the analog process for, and I don't think it makes the movie feel timeless. So I disagree with that approach by Greg Fraser, who's otherwise, I think, a good DP.
Disagree with the technique. Disagree with the result that came out of it. It looked fine, whatever. It was unnecessary.
Yeah, like if you told anybody that they did that, they'd be like, why? And if you didn't tell anybody that they did that, they wouldn't have assumed it. They did. So it's like, what's the advantage? I see none.
No, I didn't see anything either. Mm-hmm. Until next time, Denis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same Dune time, same Dune channel.
You think we're still going to have a podcast by the time the next movie comes out?
I don't know. But we'll just have like a special.
Yes.
Limited edition podcast.
Let's promise right here and now that even if the podcast is not still going, when the second Dune comes out, we will reconvene just to talk shit about the second Dune.
Yep. Well, I mean, hopefully. I mean, I would like to be happy with it, personally. I know you don't really care to pursue that
like
as an avenue.
Happy.
Yeah,
I like movies that make me happy.
Yeah, I don't see a Dune ever making you happy. But I would like to be happy someday.
Someday. That has real Michael Scott energy with the I love inside jokes. I'd like to be part of one someday.